Okay, I'd like to, or Peter's asked me to say something about atmospheric neutrinos. So what I thought I'd do is give a little historical introduction first, and then talk about the use of the atmospheric neutrino beam for particle physics, and that's a well-known story to most people nowadays, I suppose. And then talk about, make a few comments about atmospheric neutrinos in relation to the search for astrophysical neutrinos. So, the first detection of atmospheric neutrinos was in 1965, and there were two very interesting theoretical papers in 1960. One by Markov, who suggested using neutrino detectors in a lake to do neutrino physics. He used the atmospheric neutrino beam for neutrino physics. And then there was the paper by Grison, who suggested a water Cherenkov detector in a deep mine to search for extraterrestrial neutrinos. And he estimated the rate of interaction of atmospheric neutrinos in a detector at that time, and pointed out that it would be the background and calibration source. So these, from the very beginning, these two themes of using atmospheric neutrinos for particle physics and using and considering them as a background for calibration or background for neutrino search have been there.
There was also a paper by Reinestein the same year.
I wasn't aware of that. There's a paper by Reinz.
No, that's much later.
There are two. The first atmospheric neutrinos were detected in 1965 independently in two different deep mines.
No, he had an astronomy.
Okay, you'll have to show me that.
Find it.
There are two methods for calculating the atmospheric neutrinos. One is to use the genetic relation between the muons and the neutrinos, since they both come largely from pions, and measure the neutrino flux and then make an inference about the neutrino flux. And the more straightforward way is just to start with the primary spectrum and calculate everything. And this is the technique that's used by everybody now, and the reason is that the relation between muons and neutrinos is somewhat obscured by the fact that kaons are more important for neutrinos than they are for muons. So then the next thing in this story, after these early calculations, there was a new generation of calculations, which is when I got involved with this business, in the 1980s, because neutrinos, atmospheric neutrinos, are the background to the search for proton decay. And this little diagram here is E squared dNdE. So one power, it's dNd log E multiplied by the neutrino cross-section, basically. And you see that the interaction rate peaks around the GeV, just below GeV, which is where the signal for proton decay would be. So there was another round of calculations at that time. Then when the proton decay detectors started seeing hints of something funny, disagreements between calculations and observations. And so you can think of the decade between 86 and 96 is the decade of the neutrino anomaly. The beam actually produces at low energy, where the muons all decay, produces two muon neutrinos for every electron neutrino. And the first hint was from the IND experiment, which saw two Q muon decays from interactions of muon neutrinos. Kamioka experiment measured the mu to electron muon-like neutrino interactions to electron-like neutrino interactions and found that the ratio was smaller than expected from this simple from the calculations. And the first explicit suggestion of neutrino oscillations as the explanation was in a 1988 Kamioka paper. In 1992, there was a paper by IMB on the ratio of stopping to true-going muons, and they kind of shot themselves in the foot by claiming that their, that measurement was inconsistent with oscillations. And so they ruled out, with that paper, they ruled out oscillations in the range needed to explain the Kamioka result. The first hint, the key is to see path length dependence for a neutrino oscillation. The first hint of path length dependence came from the Kamioka experiment at the end of its life in 1994. And then the discovery of atmospheric neutrinos, the title of the paper in 1998 is Evidence for Neutrino Oscillations. From Super K, just the bigger detector gave enough events to really study the problem in great detail. And then there's measurements of the neutrino-induced muons by both Macro and Sudan, which also show effects of oscillations. And it's important that these analyses are mainly based on ratios. At that time, the calculations were all one-dimensional in that they assumed that all the secondaries went in the same direction as the primary. And that assumption, of course, is not true at low energy. For sub-GeV neutrinos, the ratio of transfer from minimum to energy is large, and you have to take account of the three-dimensional effects. And led to a new round of calculations. There are a lot of detailed things that come in when you do this, none of which, it turns out, is really important for interpretation of experiments. So I'm not going to spend time on that discussion today. It's not. Instead, what I'm going to do is, since we're interested in high energies here, I'm going to kind of direct my attention toward the high energy aspects of the neutrino flux story. So here's an overview of the calculation. The flux of the neutrinos is just a convolution of the primary flux with the effects of the geomagnetic field. We're working in an energy region here where the effects of geomagnetic cutoffs on the primary spectrum are important. That is, particles of sufficiently low energy don't reach the atmosphere to interact. And then there's the yield of neutrinos per interaction in the cosmic ray cascade in the atmosphere. Then, of course, it has to be done separately for protons and nuclei because of the different relation between energy per nucleon, which is what's important for particle production, and gyro radius, which is what's important for propagating through the magnetic field. So then the signal, which I won't calculate in the signal, is the convolution of the flux with the cross-section for contained events, or the convolution of the flux with the cross-section in the muon range for neutrino-induced muons. This is just a table which gives you an idea of some of the activity in the last two decades in these calculations. And I'm going to refer specifically to three calculations which are used in the recent large paper from the Super K group, in which they analyzed all their data from Super K up to the time of the accident, and they used the calculation. The primary neutrino flux calculation they used is this calculation of Honda et al., which they call A. And so I'm going to show some of the tables of their results in a minute. They use a calculation by our group, which is labeled C, and one by Battistoni et al. Called B. And these calculations are very similar, and in fact, they all three use quite a similar assumption about the primary spectrum, because we work together to try to sift through the data. And let me say a little bit about that, about the primary spectrum. And so the differences among these three calculations for the neutrino flux primarily come from differences in treatment of hadronic interactions. So here's just a figure out of the Super K paper comparing the three calculations, and you don't see much on this scale, but here they show the other three calculations normalized to the Honda et al. Calculation. You see it when you get up to high energy, difference is as large as 20% here at a TeV for the neutrino flux. Now, as I said, for the derivation of the oscillation parameters and the robustness of the result, it's very important that the results depend on ratios. And so I show you here the ratio of mu to mu e in these three calculations. Notice the scale is quite amplified here, so the calculations are all within 5% of each other. And there's when you have maximal mixing, when the theta 2-3 is the mixing angle between the nu mu and the nu tau, which is what is the basic effect in the to explain the atmospheric neutrino oscillations. When that's maximal, and this is 1, and since the ratio of muon neutrino to electron neutrino, that production is 2, it's 1/2. I'm confusing myself. This is a half, this is 2, and this is 0. This is the result that gives you the fact that when you start with a beam of with twice as many nu mu's as nu e's, you end up with equal numbers of nu mu's, nu tau's, and nu e's after propagation over a large distance compared to the mixing angle. So it's going to be hard to see, it's with atmospheric neutrinos, but because of this, it's hard to see the effects of the solar neutrino oscillations, even of the oscillation in the nu e sector, because of its cancellation. I'll come back to this at the end, and it's an advantage for the astrophysical neutrino searches, because it means that tau neutrinos will be kind of a smoking gun signal for astrophysical neutrinos. So here's the primary spectrum as it was at the time of the first, ten or 15 years ago. I'm talking about the energy range now. It's important for production of these neutrinos with energies of 1 to 10 GeV. And there's a big range of experiments. And now this has sort of been cleaned up by two experiments in the both in 1998. One, a balloon experiment called BESS, and the other one, the measurement of the primary spectrum on the AMS detector, on the test flight of AMS. And those two results are indistinguishable for protons. They're shown here with green and blue, and they're on top of each other. And there's one other balloon experiment that's still around, which seems to give somewhat lower flux, the Caprice experiment. The differences are a little bit larger between AMS and BESS for helium, but helium contributes only about 15 to 20% of the flux of nucleons. What's important, as I said, is not the all particle spectrum, but the number of nucleons per GeV per nucleon. So if you make a Powerwall fit just to these data up to 100 GeV, you get a differential spectral index of e to the minus 2.74. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to come back and talk about how we extrapolate the high energy, but let me just leave it at that and then now. Talk about these a little bit about the super K results. So the atmospheric neutrino beam, apart from geomagnetic effects, if you do the geometry, it's up-down symmetric. The neutrinos produced in the atmosphere on the other side of the Earth in a certain solid angle give the same upward flux as the same solid angle or downward going particles, and that's just a geometrical. Simple geometry to get that result. So from the point of view of neutrino oscillation experiments, you have the advantage of having one detector for both the long baseline and the short baseline part of the experiment. The neutrinos coming down are produced at about 15 kilometers in the atmosphere, and the ones coming up had propagated distances of the order of 10 to the 4th kilometer. So you have a range of 5 orders of magnitude in L over E to study with the atmospheric neutrino beam. Now, this diagram here shows the range of neutrino energies for different classes of events, and this is specifically for the super-K detector, but there are analogous things for any detector, depending on how big it is and what energy region it's exploring. So this is neutrino energy, and this is a distribution. This is dN/d log E, so the area under this curve tells you where the neutrino energies are to produce the events. And so the contained events are ones that where the neutrino comes and interacts inside the detector, and the, in a well-shielded detector like super-K, you can detect, they can measure both the upward and the downward events. Then the through-going events over here, the neutrino-induced muons, you either get stopping muons or through-going muons. And so that the energies, the neutrino energies that produce these stopping ones are lower than the neutrino energies that produce the through-going ones. And so the ratio of stopping to through-going is a measurement of the is a probe of neutrino oscillations in a certain range of L over E. The range of L is the same for both cases, but E is a factor of 10 different. And so that's one of the pieces of one of the measurements of sensitivity to the oscillations. Now I want to spend a little bit of time on this one. This is the main result of this analysis of the of, 5 years, whatever it is, of super-K data. So they've got here, I mean, at several neutrinos per day, they've got almost 10,000 neutrinos in this sample. And so roughly these diagrams go from low energy to high energy. So sub-GeV with visible momentum less than 400 MeV for electron neutrinos, for muon neutrinos, and then somewhat higher energy. And so you see I'll go back to that. But here's the formula. So the probability that the neutrino changes its identity is proportional to the mixing angle, and then the L over E dependence here. So the effect for a given energy, the effect is bigger for larger L. And let me go back to the thing here. So what's happening here is that for this low energy sample, let's look at the muon life. All the both downward going and upward going muons have suffered from identity change. So there's a deficit in both the upward and downward direction. But when you go to higher energy, the L over E is smaller, and the downward ones have not oscillated, but the upward ones have. Now, the open boxes here are the calculations of all these quantities in the absence of oscillations, and the data points here, and then the red dots are the result of the super-K fit. And in their fit, which is that table I'm going to show next, the free parameters, in addition to the mixing angle and the delta M squared, there are 38 free parameters that describe uncertainties in the calculation. They let those things float within certain sigmas, which they estimate as theoretical errors. And so one of the things you see here is that in their fit, the overall normalization has gone up. The red line is with the fit, and the electrons show no change of shape when you go from large L over E to smaller L over E. And so effectively, that's what the analysis is doing is emphasizing ratios. So here you're emphasizing the mu to mu E ratio. The electron neutrinos don't change with L over E, and the muon neutrinos do. Then you go to higher energy, and the electron neutrinos show the expected, the standard fact that you get more neutrinos near the horizontal, it's horizontal, and fewer in the vertical direction, but there's no sign of an oscillation here, and then there's a strong effect in the multi GeV muons. Now, but here is the through-going muons. Notice that in their calculation, the calculation in the absence of oscillations is below the data at large angles. And then when they do their fit, they get a good fit to the data, but this is kind of not what you would expect. The real effect is that near the horizontal, where L over E is fairly short for these high energy particles, there should be no effect, and there should be an excess at low energy. And that's just another reflection of the fact that their starting neutrino flux that they're using for the analysis is too low. And so that shows up now. This is a detailed comparison of different classes of events. The numbers measured, the numbers calculated in the three different calculations. And I'm not going to go through the contained events, but I want to focus on the high energy stuff. So let's look at this one. Notice that the measured number of events is 1800 something, and the A and the B calculations give a lower overall flux, and our calculation gives a somewhat higher flux for the neutrino-induced upward muons. Then look at this table. This is a table of some of the things where there are systematic uncertainties in the neutrino flux. So these are some of the parameters that were allowed to float and were part of the fit. And with arrows here, I've drawn attention to the big ones. In order to fit, they have a 12% increase in the overall normalization of the spectrum. They decrease the K to pi ratio by 6%. They make the primary energy spectrum of nucleons harder by 0.03 below 100 GeV and by 0.05 above 100 GeV. So remember I said that our calculation, this is called Barkov flux here, was higher. And here's the macro data compared to our calculation in the absence of oscillations. And it shows agreement for small L over E near the horizontal and a depth and an excess here. And then when you put in the oscillations as in the solid line, the vertically upward muons are depressed. And here's the super K thing where it's where because of the low normalization, it's the other way around. So to summarize, the super K fit, the overall normalization goes up by 12% actually, and the slope changes from minus 2.74 to minus 2.71 below 100 GeV and from minus 2.71 to minus 2.66 above 100 GeV. And the KAM ratio decreases by 6%. And this, in our model rather, we use this kind of primary spectrum all the way, and K to pi ratio, this should be pi here, I forgot to change fonts. The K to pi ratio actually increases. So can we use the high energy end of the super K measurements together with muon measurements to constrain the extrapolation of the neutrino spectrum to higher energy? And that's something that we're working on. I'm working on with Powell and Toto Sanef and John Thor now.
Sorry, Tom, so the 274, that's the cosmic ray spectrum or the neutrino?
Cosmic ray spectrum.
Okay. And the neutrino spectrum goes to
271. No. Because in order to fit their neutrino data, they have to take the primary spectrum index from 2.74 to 2.71. Okay? And so
you are so sensitive?
such small changes. So it's the difference 274, 271, you already...
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about small, this is now a precision measurement with some, whatever, 10,000, you know, tens of thousands of neutrinos. And so we're talking about 5%, 10% differences, adjustments.
So what would be the error to...
But they, when you extrapolate, the differences become more and more important at high energy. So I'm trying to use this information and take it to high energy and see what the consequences are.
Energy, you mean TV?
Yeah, well, more. And I'll come to that now. So in fact, here's what energies are we looking at here. So remember I showed before the neutrino energy distributions that give rise to these different classes of events. And here's the energy of the primary cosmic rays. So for the neutrino-induced upper muons, for super K, we're talking about energies, the peak is about 500 GeV, this distribution, but the median is about a TeV. So we're talking about from 100 GeV to 10 TeV being the important energy region. And then in a neutrino telescope, you're going to, because of the threshold of the detector, you cut off the... You won't be sensitive to the lower energy. It'll be even more sensitive. It'll be responding to even more high, even higher energy primaries. So here's the simple e to the minus 2.7. In fact, fit to the data. There's some new data coming in. This purple data from Attic is preliminary, and it's not normalized on this plot. But it's 2.7 is within the range of their spectral index from this preliminary data. And you know, something that makes contact with what we've been doing earlier in this conference last week, if you add all these things up and make an all particle spectrum out of it, this is how it compares to the Ayrshire data. So the Ayrshire data also, although there are significant differences between different measurements, the Ayrshire data is also suggesting that you want to keep the flux up at high energy until you get to the mean, somewhere around 2 or 3 TeV where the slope changes. By the way, the shift in energy that you need to bring the red measurement, the Debye measurement, onto the Casimir one is 23%. You need to shift the energy by something like 20%. You bring those shapes bring the magnitudes into agreement. So at high energy, you can play these games quite easily because you can use analytic approximations for the fluxes. So here's the expression for the neutrino flux. The differential neutrino flux is related to the primary flux, assuming you have a parallel spectrum, evaluated at the same energy multiplied by some factors which give you the physics. So this spectrum weighted moment is gamma plus 1 is the thing that's 2.71 or 2.74. So gamma minus 1 here is 0.71 or 7. This is just go through the standard derivation of this thing. And this gives you this one is for nucleons producing nucleons, and there are corresponding numbers. So you just read this as the nucleon produces a pion, and then the pion produces a neutrino. And there are the physics, the kinematics of the pion decay is in this factor, and the particle physics of the pion production is in this factor. And then there's the secant theta effect at high energies when the neutrino energies are above the critical energy of the pion decay. Pion decay becomes less important, and at low energies, the neutrino spectral index is the same as the primary spectrum, and at very high energies, it becomes 1 power steeper. And then there's a corresponding set of numbers for kaons. And because of the kinematics of kaon decay, since kaon is heavier than the pion, and the fact that the lifetime is shorter, the critical energy for kaons is higher. The Z factor for kaons and theta neutrinos is higher than for pions, and those two things combined.
So this energy is the atomism is negligible contribution to atomism?
The what?
Contribution of atomism is negligible in these energies?
It doesn't contribute at all. I think. Isn't it all the pi zero?
But high energy if it's cost, there's some contribution.
It decays to pi, it decays to
contribution, but I don't know what these energies.
Not the neutrino flux.
Does it produce neutrinos?
Maybe it decays to pi
charm, zero. Charm, are you thinking about charm?
Charm.
Charm, I'm going to talk about charm later, yeah. Charm is important. But anyway, the consequence is that, let's see if I can trace this diagram without getting confusing myself. This set of curves shows the contribution of tans to neutrinos, and this set tans to muons. So at above about 100 GeV, the dominant contribution of the neutrino flux is from tan decay. And of course that depends on how many tans you produce, so it is a model dependent statement, but there's going to be a crossover somewhere in anybody's model. But because of the kinematics, for pions, the behavior is quite different. The contribution of pions to neutrinos goes down, and the contribution of pions to muons stays up. And that's because when in pion decay, the mass difference is so small that the muons take most of the energy. And so the pions are always the dominant contribution to the muon flux, although the contribution of tans does increase at high energy.
Those muons are then going into neutrinos as well, right?
Yeah, except by the time you get to these energies, the muons go to the ground. So the sort of critical energy for muon decay is 2 or 3 GeV. So the muons just don't decay much.
So why are they contributing at all at the higher energies, the top line? The very topmost line?
Since it's pi to mu, this is always the the main contribution to muons is always.
Okay, so this plot just tells you how many muons you get.
This tells you that as a function of energy, pions contribute 90 or 80% of the muons, and tans contribute 10 or 20% of the muons. But for neutrinos, pions contribute 70 at low energy and 15 at high energy, and tans contribute more. So tans dominate the neutrino flux at high energy. And then because of the branching ratios, the tans are the only source of electron neutrinos at high energy because muons don't decay anymore. They reach the ground before they decay. So this is just a plot of the differences for different people's models of tan production. And by the time you get to a PEV, you can have almost factors of two difference in the neutrino flux, depending on what's assumed about tan production. It's always important to normalize, to check your calculation or your neutrino calculation against the muon fluxes, and here's the high energy version of that where I've compared our calculated muon flux, and the most recent data on here is from the L3 experiment, these purple points here. So this is all, again, with this e to the minus 2.7 seconds. So that's what I'm going to use. I'm going to use that, and now I want to, in the last few minutes here, what I want to do is make some comments, go into higher energy, and just say some random comments about atmosphere neutrinos as calibration and background for astrophysical neutrinos. So the nu mu to nu e ratio here's 10 GeV. And so around 10 GeV, the ratio is already getting quite large because the muons are no longer decaying. And that happens first near the vertical and later for the horizontal ones, because the horizontal muons have farther to go and they have more time to decay. So, but this this is just a basic property of the atmosphere and the decay properties. Now, it has an interesting feature. If you, I don't know if it may be a little at too low an energy to use, but the horizontal to vertical ratio of electron neutrinos is completely different in around 100 GeV from muon neutrinos. So if you could, if you had a detector that had maybe somewhat smaller spacing than Amanda, and you could measure the directions of cascades at 100 GeV, you should see this strong ratio of horizontal to vertical neutrinos for electron neutrinos.
Tom,
what determines in the previous plot the ratio of muon to electron at high energy is saturation at like
30? It's the Fermi ratio of kaons to neutrinos. Yes. And so that, so here there's no muon decay at all.
So this would change again if you go up in energy where kaons are.
Yeah, if you've got well, no, because the kaons, the other branching ratio, the other channels of the kaons will be contributing to the muons as well, so the ratio will saturate.
And eventually when charm dominates,
then when charm, yeah, I'm not sure what happens to the ratio when charm, when you get to the charm region. Depends on the branching ratios of the. There's another. This is a well-known property of underground muons, which I think should be a useful tag for calibrating any neutrino detector. The statement is that the shape of the energy spectrum of the muons at the detector is independent of depth when you go deep enough, about deeper than about 1.5 kilometers. And so, similarly, the energy of muons from different angles at a given depth should be the same. So here's the spectrum of neutrino-induced muons. This is muon energy now, that's what I'm plotting here. And atmospheric neutrino-induced muons. And here's the distribution of energy deposited by downwind atmospheric muons. And it sort of has a shape similar to what you would get from an astrophysical source of neutrinos with a hard spectrum, neutrino-induced muons. So this is something I think is an interesting calibration, piece of information for calibrating a detector. So here's a summary of the neutrino spectrum from very low energy up to very high energy. And I've just taken let me just make some comments now about the calculation, I mean about the shape of this plot. So the spectrum of neutrinos from prion and kaon decay changes from e to the minus 2.7, somewhere in this range around 10 to 100 GeV, gradually changes to e to the minus 3.7, and that's because of the competition between interaction and decay of the parent particles. And so if there's no charm production, the atmospheric neutrino spectrum is very steep. In fact, at this energy, it's even steeper because of the knee of the spectrum. So it becomes something like this part here has a slope of a 4. And when you get the energies above about 10 to the 5th GeV. But the contribution from charm decay, because the charm particles decay quickly, their ratio of production compared to pions and kaons is similar. If they continue to have a hard slope, so you're going to get from charm decay until you get it to about 10 to the 8 GeV, which is a critical energy for charm, you're going to have a spectrum, a hard spectrum, e to the minus 2.7, or if you're beyond the knee, e to the minus 3. And then, and so that's a problem, a concern, I guess, we say nowadays, for looking for a diffuse neutrino signal. So here's the the flux estimate that Ellie showed yesterday divided by 2 to account for oscillation, for the fact that half the muons are going to go away. And it's crossing the atmospheric neutrino flux just in the range where there's a difference depending on what you assume about charm production. Here's the current Amanda upper limit, which is about an order of magnitude, just only a factor of 10. It's within a factor of 10 of this bound, and it's squeezing down on this, closing in on this interesting level, interesting flux level.
This is per Stavesian or integrated?
No, the way I plotted my flux here it's integrating over all directions. And I've done the corresponding thing with the limits here. And of course, the limits apply only to upward. So you should divide everything by 2 if you want to, or divide it by 4 pi if you want to do for stair radians. But they're all treated the same way. Here's a plot out of the paper about the sensitivity of ice cube that was published last year. And what's shown here is the channel multiplicity in ice cube for atmospheric neutrinos with 2 different assumptions about charm production. This one is essentially 0 charm production. It's the QCD model, and this one is I think I wrote the reference on the, no, it's a model of Bugayev et al. And then here's the e to the minus 2 signal spectrum, but at a high level. And if I put on there the Lachman-Bacall flux accounting for oscillations again, it's something like this. I just sketched it, so this is not absolutely accurate, but it's something like that. And so these 30 or so events are going to be above a background of maybe 5 or 10 events from diffuse neutrinos. I mean, from prompt neutrinos. So let me summarize. The discovery of neutrino oscillations depends on ratios, and that's why it's a robust result. The super K fits. Suggests a relatively hard spectrum, both for the neutrinos and for the primaries. And this uncertainty in the level, if any uncertainty in the level of charm production is going to limit the sensitivity to diffuse astrophysical neutrinos, which means that point sources are even more important than they, obviously point sources is what we want to detect, but they're very important. Now, the ratio of flavors in atmospheric neutrinos, this number, of course, is energy dependent here. At low energies, it's 1 to 1/2, or it's 1 to 1 because of oscillations. At high energy, there's no oscillations, and the electron neutrinos go away, so it's of the order of 1 to 10. And then tau neutrinos are very low. I guess Ina will talk about tau neutrinos tomorrow. So cascades are either electron neutrinos or tau neutrinos. I think they're the thing to look for when we're searching for astrophysical neutrinos against the foreground of atmospheric neutrinos.
This adjustment that you mentioned in terms of the kaon phion production channel, is that permissible in terms of particle physics?
Yeah, I think so, and that's what Powell and Porter and I are doing now, is looking at old data on lambda production from ISR to make sure that, and what we want to do is find the maximum reasonable extrapolation and sort of see what the range of possibilities is. but I think so.
Okay. You mentioned that you're working on a calculation where you're going to use the muon flux and the low energy super K data to try to constrain the higher energy neutrino flux. How much better do you think you'll be able to do with that calculation? Ready to show?
In what sense? I mean, I think one of my goals here is when there are Amanda papers to have to replace the Volkova flux, which is what's always shown in Amanda papers and IC papers. And I think you're in a position now to do a much better job of that because there's a lot more known about the primary spectrum. We're going to use the all-particle measurements, the Ayrshire measurements as well to constrain the high energy. And that's the biggest uncertainty, I think. That and CAM production.
And typically, we quote the answer.
And now CHARM is another story, which it may be that Amanda has already measured CHARM production. I don't know. I mean, do you think there's any sensitivity to prompt neutrinos now? Prompt muons? Neutrinos just muons?
Well, it's a hard experiment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of systematics in that. But what I'm saying is, typically we're quoting 20-25% uncertainty in the flux of the neutrinos of these energies. And so I'm just wondering if you think they'll go down by factor 2?
Well, I hope so, yeah. I mean, it can't be any better than that, just because the limited amount of information about CAM production.
So, when you showed that analytic formulas for the ion and kaon contributions,
mm-hmm.
that derived from some scaling representation to the data of ion and CAN production?
Yeah.
And it comes out to be that simple?
Well, I think when we actually do the calculation, we'll do proper calculations with all the energy dependencies in. But it's a guide. It's a very useful guide to analyzing, seeing what the range of possibilities is.
As far as addressing the max composition near the mean, it doesn't seem like you can do much with the atmospheric neutrino signature, is that right?
Yeah, because the when you classify nuclei by energy per nucleon, it depresses the nuclei relative to the protons. Or enhances the protons relative to the nuclei. And vice versa, when you classify particles by energy per nucleus, it enhances you get more, obviously more energy per nucleus in heavy nuclei for a given energy per nucleon.
So, why didn't you compare the atomic experiment with the cascade? Rather than Tibet, as well as Tibet.
Wait, why didn't I compare it to what? To
you showed the Tibet, the Ayrshire data near the knee.
Yeah.
And to the attic experiment data. Isn't Cascada more reliable?
Not for the primary spectrum measurement, I don't think, because they're so deep in the atmosphere. I mean, they're good for, they do have a primary spectrum, and it's within the range of those things, but because of the sea level, in principle, the Tibet measurement should be the best because it's at high altitudes. And the Cascade measurement has it's a very good detector, and so they had very good sensitivity to ratios of electrons and muons, basically, and they have some information about hadrons, so they can do a good job. They do the best job of composition, but I wouldn't give their energy spectrum measurement preference over others.
Yeah, I think the problem is just this lack of certainty about the atomic interactions of these energies. It's Tolman illustrated on the magazine.
And one of the, yeah, okay.
Tom, what's the uncertainty in the position of the peak of the nu e plus nu e bar horizontal to vertical ratio? You said it was about 100 GPP.
I don't think there's very little uncertainty in that because it's basically a ratio. I mean, you can move the number of electron neutrinos up or down by changing the ion production, but that feature would be second order of sensitivity because the reason for the feature is the fact that these cans are more important near the vertical than near the horizontal.
Questions?
Okay, thanks very much.